Good morning to each one this morning. Good to be gathered together again for collective worship. As we've already heard this morning, appreciated the thoughts that have been given. I suppose most of you know that we were gone for 3 weeks to Bible school. Just got home last evening. And so trying to get settled back into home life here and to church life in Halsey. Had a good term, seemed like real good. There was, I believe it was 54 students, a few less than what normally has been. Lots of times it's more like in the mid-60s. But as I recall, Brother Nolan was the principal, and he gave a few statistics there on the night of the program. I believe he said there was students from 11 states and 2 provinces, 5 countries. Other than the U.S. and Canada, there was Guatemala and Belize and Ukraine. So we had quite a wide variety of students from different localities, different constituencies as far as fellowships and so on. But it was good. One thing that was probably a little different this year. Usually we try to have school for the school children of the staff that are there. And this year there were a lot of children. There may have been less students, but it probably took as much food because there were 25 children of staff that was there. And enough school children that we had to have 2 teachers. And so that was a little bit different. But it seemed like all went well. All put themselves to it. And I guess I wasn't necessarily asked to give a report here. So if you want more of a report, we can fill you in a little bit later. Wasn't sure what to share here this morning, after coming back from being involved 3 weeks with my mind going strong on the subject that I taught. I taught American Mennonite history and the subject of separation. And I guess the message here this morning is somewhat of a, not really a combination of those two, but some thoughts that would have come out in both of those classes. And so I'd like to talk this morning on the subject of separation of church and state. I think that we do believe this, and I want to go back just a little bit and pick up a little bit of background on this. But we believe that the church and the state should be separate in their operation, that we should not tell the state what to do, and neither do we appreciate if the state tries to tell us how we should operate our churches and so on. I think we understand that. But you know, historically, this has not been the case. Historically, the state has been very much involved in operating the church. And so as we looked at the history of the Mennonites in America, of course we needed to go back to Europe and what was going on there. And there was not the freedom there to have a church that operated outside of the state's control. And if you know your history at all, if throughout the European countries, back in the 1400s, 1500s, even 1600s, the Catholic Church had such a strong hold on all the people and all the political leaders, and nothing could be done but what it was sanctioned by the Catholic Church. And so there got to be a lot of discontent and a desire to be out from underneath its rule. And so there were reformers that began to break from Catholicism, from the yoke of Romanism. And there was a great spiritual awakening among many of the people because the Word of God began to disseminate among them. The Bible was printed and in their own language and some of those things. But many of the reformers did not go back to a biblical concept of a body of believers as a church. But rather, their thought was, I guess this is really all they would have known, their thought was that the whole populace would be under the church. And if you know anything about the 30-year war in Europe, the armies swept back and forth across Europe, and I forget now, but it seems to me like the people would have changed their church affiliation maybe 7 times during that 30-year war, something like that. So the Catholics would be in charge, then the Protestants, and so on. And so there were those in the midst of all of that havoc, I guess you'd say, who desired to have a church that was based on the Bible, based on what the Bible had to say about a church, and not about what Rome had to say about it or one of the reformers. And they wanted to be operated as it was in apostolic times. And so we find those who broke away from the state church, and they were, I guess you'd say, misunderstood. They were maligned. They were persecuted. They were driven from one place to another. You have no place here because you're not a part of our citizenship, or you should be, and you're not really fitting in. And these people, as they went from place to place, they found no place where they could rest. No place where they could live out their convictions. And so they would live here for a time, then they would live there. And the government and state being together, they put a lot of pressure on them to conform to what they wanted. But finally, there was a door of opportunity that was open in America. And I think most of you are somewhat acquainted how that was, how William Penn invited the persecuted of Europe to come to Pennsylvania. And it wasn't just the Mennonites, there were others as well. And so when they came to this land of freedom, here they were free to, you might say, flourish in their own personal lives. They were able to worship freely, according to what they believed and according to their own practices, and without being forced by the government to be part of a state approved church. And so as they came to this land of freedom, this was new. They had always been told what they could do and what they couldn't do. But now here they had the freedom to respond how they felt that the scriptures taught. And so the question came up, should they be a part of the civil government? I mean, after all, the Quakers there in Pennsylvania, they were pacifist or non-resistant. I'm not sure quite how to classify them there. And so there were some of the Mennonite people who served in local political offices and felt that they could find a place there. Then there was a question of should they cast their vote for the preference of who should be leading out in the affairs of the state. And that took a little bit of time to sort through that. One interesting thing that came up, at least in my study here, in the early days of Pennsylvania there, the Quakers were in government position. William Penn was a Quaker, and William Penn invited the people to come, and William Penn kind of set up the government, and the Quakers were in charge, and they intended there, they had what was called as a holy experiment. They intended to govern in such a way that the society could be changed by political means. They felt that if they governed in the right way, in the way of the scriptures, that it would make a difference in society, and it would change society. And they intended to influence men by using law to control evil. But they did not use force, of course, to do that. Well, as a little time went on, probably another 50 years or so, there got to be more immigrants that came, and particularly, I think it was the Irish and the Scots that would have settled in the western part of Pennsylvania, along the mountains. And there were Indian uprisings. And they would appeal to the legislature of Pennsylvania. We need help. We got to be protected from what's going on. We need a militia. And the Quakers would say, no, we can't do that. And so finally, I think it was in 1854, there was an election. So what's going to happen here? There were those that said, we need somebody in place that will meet the needs of our and have a militia. And there were others that said, you know, we appreciate the quiet ways, the peaceable ways of the Quakers. And so there was quite a difference of opinion, and there was an election there, and the Mennonites, I guess you would say, voted by the droves to keep the Quakers in power, but it didn't work. There was enough interest in having a government that would set up a militia to protect them and so on. And it seemed that maybe through that experience, the Mennonites decide, you know, we cannot control men by voting. And that's been an ongoing debate, I guess, even since then. So that's a little bit what we've run into in the history class. Then in my separation class, we had a chapter that was entitled "The Christian in the State." And it had four different main headings, where we looked at aspects of love and obedience and responsibility and allegiance. And as I looked at the material for both of these classes, I was impressed again of the blessings that we have as non-resistant Christians to be under a government that allows us to operate our churches and our schools independent of their control. And, you know, today across the world, there's not very many places that would have the privileges that we have here today. And so our government, even though there's a lot of things that we probably wish were different, do not try to regulate the way we operate our churches. You know, the Anabaptists have been truly appreciative of these freedoms. And, many times, even today, it's interesting. It's been over 300 years, I guess, since the first Mennonites came to America. But even today, in our worship services, that appreciation for the freedom we have comes through. As I was thinking about this, I don't know how many times that I heard my pop pray something to this effect, that to thank the Lord that we can meet unhindered and unmolested. Ever heard that? Something along that line? That goes clear back to the appreciation that we've had for the government in which we live for these centuries. And so a true separation of the church from the state and its systems was a strong teaching of the early Anabaptists. And they believed and they challenged the authorities. They said there should be liberty of conscience, that a person should have the privilege to have a conscience that they can live out the way that they believe that they should. And so there was, that goes clear back to the beginning of the Anabaptist movement. All right, so much for background. I'd like to, this morning then, give just a little bit, this can't be exhaustive, but a little bit of biblical background on the subject of the church and the state and how they operate different one from another. The first thing that I would mention is that there are two kingdoms. Now, in a separation class, we talked about two kingdoms from a spiritual angle, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of Satan. But in this here, I'm going to talk a little bit different from a different angle, that there are two kingdoms. And what's interesting is that both of these kingdoms, even though they are distinct one from another, yet they are both under the authority of God. There is the kingdom of the church, there is the kingdom of the state. And the state has been given authority by God to take care of the natural order of the nations. We could go to the book of Daniel, and chapter 4 there is interesting, as Nebuchadnezzar rehearsed what had happened to him, how he was taken down from the throne, and that he ate grass like an ox, and then later he came back into to rule. And he said that this happened until he recognized that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of man and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And I think that is something that we need to continually keep in mind. You know, we wonder sometimes why there are certain evil men that are placed in position in nations, and those who are ungodly, and how they may promote things that that just ought not to be. But we need to realize that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of man and giveth it to whomsoever he will. Now, on the other hand, the church is a kingdom that cares for the spiritual welfare of man. And so, as believers, the cause of the church is too great to be in the part of the other kingdom, even though it is under the authority of God. And so in all places, Jesus and the apostles recognized the rulers and obeyed and revered them as much as possible. I'd like to read several verses from 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 to 17. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme, or unto governors, as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. So here we have in this 17th verse the aspect of loving the brotherhood, which is the church, and to honor the king, which is the state. And it says here that we should submit ourselves, whether it's to the king or to governors or those that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers. If you would, now let's turn to Romans. Romans, I think I'll read part of Romans 13. We know that this talks about the place of the state. If we had the time, maybe I should just read all of Romans 12 as well. And I'd like to keep in mind that Romans 12 speaks of the church and how the church should operate. Romans 13 speaks of the state and how the state should operate. In Romans 12, we have we. In Romans 13, we have they. And so it's not the same people. All right. I'm going to read the first seven verses of Romans 13. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of man. And they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he, not we, for he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore ye must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause pay ye tribute also, For they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. So twice in this passage, at least, it calls the rulers of the nations or the land in which we live a minister of God. Now, shouldn't it be a goal of the child of God to be a minister of God? Yes, but not in this kingdom. Okay, I'd like to go down through just a few things here. First of all, let's look at the purpose of the state and the church, and the power of the state and the church, and the authority and regulation of the state and the church, and just look at these as contrasting entities. And so, on the state, because God is a God of justice, He has ordained the state to execute judgment on the evildoer. And we already read that in 1 Peter 2. I don't think I'll go back to that. But you know, sin must be punished. And who's going to punish sin? And so God has set up earthly rulers to do that. We notice here in Romans 13, verse 4, it says, "For he is a minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is a minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil." Now, I hope that is not speaking of leadership in the church. A revenger to execute wrath. But God has set up those in the state to do this, that sin must be punished. Now, I think it's just, we need to realize, even though some people say we live in a Christian nation, whatever, we need to realize that the government of the land does not operate on the basis of the Bible. I haven't been stopped by a police officer real often, but often more often than I'd like to have been. But I have yet being stopped by a policeman to have him come to my window and have the Bible in his hand and say, "Well, now let's see here in such and such a chapter, such and such a verse, this is what you've done wrong." No, that's not the way it is. He goes according to the laws that has been made by the land and by those whom God has placed in authority to oversee the doings of men. You know, the government does not operate on the basis of mercy. I've just been impressed with that. You know, as a church, we like to try to work through situations. And if someone has erred, we try to help them. But you know, the state they have their laws. And they have the punishment for those laws. And you can repent and you can say you're sorry and you can make restitution. But the law is a law, and that's what it goes by. So that's the purpose of the state. Now, the purpose of the church is much different than that. The purpose of the church is to spread the gospel. We have the Great Commission to go and to teach and to preach and to baptize, to show sinners a holy God. And you know, this is such a higher calling than to be a judge or to be a district attorney or to be a policeman out on the road. And so the church needs to let its light shine to glorify God. And it's a haven for a soul. It's a haven for the sinner. It's a haven for those who have done wrong. It's a haven for those who have disobeyed the laws of the land. And so regeneration is the goal of the church. Not just good works, but a life that is changed because of a new life within. I'm going to read now from Romans 12, verses 6 to 10, just a portion of Romans 12. And this now is speaking of the church, how the church should operate, not the state, but the church. Romans 12, verse 6. "Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth with diligence. He that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. Let love be without dissimulation. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. Be kindly affectioned one to another, with brotherly love and honor, preferring one another. I don't know if you pick it up or not, but to me there's just such a different tone here. Now we also have in here the word minister. We have, let's see, we have evil and good. And so it's different. We're to be kindly affectioned. We're to have brotherly love. We're to prefer one another. We're to abhor that which is evil. We're to cleave to that which is good. But that's still a little bit different than what we find in the next chapter where the minister of God is a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. All right, so let's think just a little bit about what power is given to the state and to the church. The power that the state has actually comes from God. It's not something that they have taken unto themselves. It seems like it sometimes. We have maybe a uprising or rebellion, and there's some man that wants to take over and take the nation the way he wants to. But that's allowed by God. Notice in Romans 13, verse 1, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. And so I think it is well for us as Christians to remember that the state is a power and has a power that's given by God. Jesus told Pilate, when he was before Pilate, and Pilate says, don't you know I have the right or the ability to crucify you or to put you to death? Jesus said, thou couldest have no power at all against me except it were given thee from above. And so that power that Pilate had, and that power that he used to crucify Jesus, was given by God. Now, you know, sometimes so-called Christians become very active, very involved in a political cause of their country. And I was thinking back a little bit. I don't know a lot of all the history has to do with World War II. But, you know, there were those Christian people who felt like in the earlier days that Hitler was really, he was really promoting some things that were godly, like against homosexuality and some of those things. Well, then, of course, there were those on the other side that saw him as an evil man. And so in some ways, you almost had Christians pitted against Christians. So if you take that to its logical end, a war like that, you have God fighting God. Because there are those who were fighting for the cause because of what they thought was God expected. You have somebody else fighting for the cause. And so we have God fighting God. Doesn't make any sense at all. All right. So in the church, what's the power of the church? Well, we know that the power of the church is spiritual. And that power is not by wielding the sword. Jesus said, all power is given unto me in heaven and in earth. And so he gave that power then to the church. So the Father had given all power to his Son, and Jesus extends that power to the church. And the power that Jesus has, that he received, that he passes on, is the power of the resurrection. And we could go into that aspect. But I think that's so true, that the power that he has is in the resurrected life. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 2:4, and my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of wisdom, of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. And so the Apostle Paul said that he preached the power through the Spirit. Then on Romans 12 here, verse 19, it says, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. And so as a church, we don't avenge, we don't take vengeance, because God does that. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. So the early reformers that I talked about tried to do all that they could to force people into subjection to what they had set up, church, regular, state church and so on, but that was a failure. Alright, so now let's think a little bit further about the authority that is being given to the state and to the church. We noticed in chapter 13, verse 4 of Romans 13, 4, that the state is a revenger. And so that is a power that's been given to them. Now, we don't necessarily approve of all the deeds of the rulers. And I guess just to be practical here, we probably not any of us here really approve of all of the statements and actions and deeds of President Trump. Now, I'm not here to Trump or un-Trump you. But what I'm saying is that God doesn't necessarily approve of all the deeds, but He has given them the duty to be an avenger, to take care of wrongdoing. And so the state punishes sin with sin. I think we need to get that picture in mind. Maybe that's hard to get or wrap our mind around, that they are the ministers of God, and yet they're sinning. They're sinning by doing what God has asked them to do. And so we believe that their authority is limited. But Jesus did recognize the authority of the state. He said that Caesar had a right to collect taxes. And yet, on the other hand, the apostles said in Acts 4:19, whether it be right in the sight of God to hearken to you more than to God, God judge. In other words, we're going to do what God says, regardless of what you say. So if we must disobey for conscience' sake, we do it humbly. Nowhere in the Scriptures do I find the qualifications for a government leader. We have a number of places where there's qualifications given for church offices, but not for a government leader. Okay, so what then is the authority of the church? Well, the church is limited to the headship of Christ. Ephesians 1:22 says, "And hath put all things under His feet, and gave Him to be the head over all things to the church." And so the Father gave the Son to be head over all things to the church, and Christ then gives the church the authority and the responsibility to keep itself pure. I don't think we'll take the time this morning, but we could turn to Matthew 18. And Jesus told us there how, gave us directives of how to correct difficulties among brethren. And we could go to 1 Corinthians 5. And there is outlined guidelines as far as expelling someone from the fellowship that is a sinner. I'd like to read from 2 Corinthians 10. 2 Corinthians 10, 3 to 5. "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." So our weapons are not carnal. The weapons of conquest for the Christian are not a sword. They're not a bomb. They're not a gun. But through the Spirit of God. So I trust we can see that the church and the state are both ordained of God, but for different purposes. And so where do we want to be on this? I just have a few things I'd like to mention. I've already mentioned some of these. But the relation of the Christian to the state. How should we as Christians relate to the state? How should we be involved or not involved? Well, the first that I have is obedience. And I've already read that in Romans 3, 1 to 3, where we are... maybe I'll just read that again. Romans 3, 1, 13, 1 to 3. "Let every soul be subject," and I would take that to be obedient, "to the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. And so we need to be obedient. I believe also that Christians need to pay their taxes. I'm going to also read here again from Romans 13, verses 6 to 7. For this cause pay ye tribute also, for they are God's ministers, attending continually upon this very thing. Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Now there are those who take a pacifist position that say, I'm not going to pay any taxes, what's going to be used for military reasons. So maybe I don't know how they all do it. Maybe they figure out what percentage of the budget is military and only pay that percent of their taxes or whatever. That's not what Romans 13 says. It says, pay your tribute. Tribute to whom tribute is due, custom to whom custom, so on. And so that is not a responsibility to say how the taxes are used, but to be appreciative of what we have. All right, the third thing that we should do as far as our relation is to pray. And I'm going to read 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2. 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 2. I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and honesty. And so we are exhorted here to pray and to intercede and to give supplications and to give thanks. I don't think these prayers should necessarily be intended to overthrow corrupt government. Now maybe there's a place for that, I'm not quite sure. Or to change the political system in which we live. That's not what it's saying here. But it should be for the good of God's people. Our prayers should be for the church. Our prayers, I believe, should be concerning the government in relation to how they relate to God's people. Now, in some ways it maybe amused me just a little bit, but I thought about that quite a bit. This booklet on separation and nonconformity put out by Christian Light, the one statement in that chapter there said, it pointed out that we cannot give thanks for somebody whom we are continually criticizing. Something to think about. If we're continually criticizing somebody, can we really thank God for them? All right, then we come to the point of voting. I've already talked about this. If we cannot support a government in war and in other aspects, then how can we try to direct them and guide them by way of voting? The government cannot operate on a non-resistant level. And therefore, how can the Christian attempt to govern the government? And so, it seems somewhat of a paradox, I guess you'd say. I don't know if that's the right term. But we should have difficulty in helping to vote in a man that does something that we can't do. So can I help vote in a sheriff? Well, you're saying, well, I'm just simply giving my preference of who I think should be. Well, maybe there's something to that. I think in reality, it's best if we stay away from all political involvement. And another statement that was made in that separation book was this: God never loses an election. Probably some of you older ones remember the election of 1960 when J.F. Kennedy was, okay, Ernest is shaking his head. There was a lot of concern among the Mennonite people John F. Kennedy not be put into office. And there was quite a campaign among the Mennonites to get out and vote because we don't want him in. The reason we didn't want him in was because he was a Roman Catholic. Never had a Roman Catholic as a president before. And there was a lot of fear about that. I remember following that. There was a little tract that was put out. And the title of it was, Did God Lose the Election? Simple question is no. Or simple answer is no. Okay. Another thing in relation to in relation to the Christian and the state is that we should not be active in trying to reform the government. You know, there's a tendency in the Christian, and especially in a land of freedom, to want to exert influence for the right and endeavor to bring about reform. And there's all kinds of causes, and a lot of those causes are good, and there's getting to be more and more of them. And, you know, when you talk about abortion, and when you talk about the alternate lifestyle, and when you talk about all these things, I mean, there's things that you just wish there could be laws that could be made to do away with those things. But laws are not going to change people. It's only the power of the blood of Christ that's going to change people. I think we need to keep that in mind. And so there might be petitions, and there might be protests and various things, but, you know, in actuality, the reform work in a political sense minimizes sin. Now you think about that a little bit. If we try to get the government to Christianize the society in which we live, it kind of paints over and does a whitewash job on sin. But sin itself has not been taken care of. And so I think it's the church's place to speak about the sinful condition of man rather than to reform him in his present condition. And I think about John the Baptist, you know, about Jesus. When John the Baptist was imprisoned and beheaded, you know, Jesus did not cry out against the cruelty and the tyranny of Herod. And I'd like to read also in Luke 13, there were some people that came to Jesus, and I think they thought they had a foolproof case here. Luke 13, they said there were present at that season some that told him of the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Now here was a man, Pilate, and you know, Jesus knew that shortly this Pilate was going to be one that would condemn him to death, and so, I mean, he was an ungodly man. He was cruel. Not only cruel, he was sacrilegious. Well, surely Jesus would respond to this. Look what the ruler did. Jesus said to them, "Suppose ye that these Galileans were sinners above all the Galileans because they suffered such things? I tell you, nay, but except ye repent, ye shall all likewise perish." So Jesus brought it right. He took it out of the political realm and went right to the core of the matter as far as their relationship with God, that they need to repent. And so rather than condemning Pilate, he reminded his hearers of their own personal need to repent. Jesus only had time to speak of the fundamental problem, and that was sin. You know, Paul lived in the day of the cruelest of rulers, Nero. And I don't even find the name Nero here in the New Testament. But what did he write there in Romans? You know, that we need to be subject. We don't read in epistles any reference to influence government toward right legislation. We think of Lot. How much good did he do in reforming Sodom? We think of Moses. How much good did he do there in Egypt until God sent him out to the wilderness for 40 years? Then he did a lot of good. Moses couldn't change the evils in Egypt. And so as God's people, that's not our place, that's not our position. And so I'd like to sum this up this morning just with the challenge. We need to choose where our allegiance is. Is our allegiance with the ministers of the state, or is it with the church? You know, ideally, there should be no distinction between the church and the state, but we know that that's not true. You know, if the state would actually be Christian, it would be the church. But it's not. And so since it's not Christian, Christ has provided a place of a haven, a place that we can thrive in our Christian life, and that's the church. And so we as His people are called to a life of separation, both from the world and from the state. Now, separation from political things does not necessarily mean that we are aloof, that we have no interest, that we are ignorant and we lack love and we lack concern for those in government. No, but it does mean that we don't become involved. I'd like to quote from Origen, one of the early church fathers. He said this, "It is not for the purpose of escaping public duties that Christians decline public offices, but that they may reserve themselves for a diviner and more necessary service in the Church of God for the salvation of men." And so he said, it's not to get out of work that we refrain from this, but it's because we have more necessary work. And so we can choose between two ways. And I believe that in many ways they both accomplish good, and they are both ordained of God. But one is for time, it's for here, and the other is for eternity. And so I believe that this morning that we want to be a part of those who are building for eternity and not just trying to make and keep laws here in this world. Let's have a closing number in song.